Okay, welcome everyone to this event organized by Global Visions, in which we discuss climate change from the point of view of justice, solutions and future visions. My name is Max Talbari. I'm the founder and chairperson of the Global Visions Association. We act as a platform for the discussion on how the state of the world can be improved, especially from the point of view of global justice and equality. And we also highlight different societal visions regarding all of this. So this panel discussion is being filmed and it will be made available soon on our webpage for those who wish to revisit the discussion or share it with others. And we will also follow this event up by discussing a global carbon tax as a specific solution to climate change. And this event will take place also here in Musiikkitalo on the 17th of September. But for this event, we have with us Associate Professor Senja Laakso, who is Associate Professor of Consumption Culture and Social Practices at the Center for Consumer Society Research at the University of Helsinki, Professor Anja Nygren, who is Professor of Global Development Studies and Director of the Doctoral Program in Political, Societal and Regional Changes at the University of Helsinki, and Dr. Bon Huego, who is a political economist and senior lecturer in International Development Studies at the University of Jyväskylä.
Thank you, Max. So I'm Astrid Aminoff, the project planner at Global Visions, and I will be the moderator for this section of the event. And firstly, I would like to thank everyone for coming out tonight, especially our guests and volunteer and photographer as well. But as we are short on time, let's get right into the discussion. And the first theme we will be discussing is climate justice. So the first question I would like Bon to start, and then Anja can continue, and Senja can, of course, comment. So human activities are pushing planetary boundaries, while those least responsible, particularly in the global south, suffer the greatest consequences. Is justice adequately addressed in current climate action? And yes, so Bon, I would like you to start. Is justice adequately addressed in current climate action?
Well, not obviously, it's not climate justice is not adequately addressed in a lot of climate action, especially northern-led climate action, which is very economistic. When in fact, what we need is a comprehensive and holistic response. So what we are witnessing is the continuity of climate injustice. And we are not witnessing justice, but impunity. And I think impunity is the culture and the practice that sustains injustice. Impunity meaning that the rich countries and the powerful MNCs, the fossil empires, can just get away with their past, present, and future crimes. And this so-called northern-led climate action is pursued on the basis of national interest rather than on a global vision or a global perspective. And then they are not addressing the climate crisis in a holistic manner. So there's no sense of just sustainability. You know, they do and talk about sustainable development, but then it's still very economistic. They reduce issues to mere financial question, but they don't understand sustainability from the point of view of justice. And justice has many dimensions and meaning. And in climate justice discourse, the key aspects would be, for instance, recognition justice. We haven't even heard sorry and admission on the part of the global north for the harms and damages done historically. That's an aspect in recognition justice. There's also redistribution justice. And the way they distribute resources, it's still based on their economistic and profitable calculations. on the basis of national interests. And then there's also this so-called procedural justice. So it's at the international institution decision-making level where the most affected Global South countries are not part of the decision-making process. So there is this systematic exclusion happening, you know, procedurally. Even at the procedural level, they are not giving that to the Global South. So we demand, for instance, historical justice or recognition justice, but the response of the Global North is historical denialism. Yeah? And then we demand for redistributive justice, the response of corporations and rich country governments would be greenwashing. And then there are all those injustices that are being perpetuated. It's because of this very myopic sense of justice they're doing. But let's also say and belittle ourselves being part of the so-called global justice or climate justice movement, because we have done and attained some, at least at the discursive and institutional level. There are talks now about climate justice. It has been slow, but you know, there is this saying that the arc of the moral universe is long, but eventually it will bend towards justice. And we all know in this struggle, you know, climate justice is a struggle. And we don't know that it's not a walk in the park. It will take a long, long time. But we have attained, but we keep on pushing so that others would have a sense of urgency and really act on it. Because there's no sense of initiative. You know, how do northern countries react on major global crisis if they are feeling it? Remember what happened during the pandemic. Yeah, it's because the global north, especially Europe and the United States, have been suffering from the deaths in the pandemic. So science and resources were all mobilized to address that because they felt it. But if that pandemic or epidemic is happening in the global south, you know, resources won't be mobilized accordingly. So in the climate conference that happened in Egypt, when they had the loss and damage clause, they acted because there were forest fires happening and floods, extreme weather events happening in the United States and Europe. You know, when things and disasters and dangers are felt, you know, by the richer countries. I mean, that's the only time they act. Yeah. So, in a way, we are seeing also here this sense of indifference and also hypocrisy. Yeah. But then what we are pushing them is to have this sense of climate justice, which requires a global vision, a global perspective, and a sense of history.
Thanks, Juan. Would Anya like to comment?
Yeah, maybe I can add what Juan was saying. Like, we can ask what kind of justice and justice for whom? And as Juan was saying, there are different dimensions in justice, in climate justice or in any kind of justice. We often speak of three R's or even four R's. Like resource redistribution is one aspect. Then recognition, then representation. And I myself have added another R, which is recovery or repair. So resource redistribution, institutional recognition, political representation, and social repair, and they link together. what is meant by these four R's? We can take, for example, the question of strategic raw materials or critical minerals that are needed for energy transition, for electric cars and so on. So in the case of resource distribution or redistribution, we have to look at how the benefits and costs are redistributed in the extraction, processing, trade, and consumption of those materials. Concerning the institutional recognition, it means, for example, aspects of how resource rights are recognized. Do we recognize those, for example, local resource rights when we start to extract minerals here and there? And political representation means whose voice is heard and whose suggestions and decisions count. As Bon was saying, there is much injustice and inequality there. And then repair means that there are different dimensions. If we think, for example, climate justice, we can consider, for example, of those different kind of climate disasters, that how the consequences of them, how unevenly they are distributed, and how unevenly people get their voices heard. Or we can also think, for example, how I think it's also important when we speak about climate justice, not only to think about how to make the green transition, but also to think what happens in those huge areas where we have had coal mining or where we have had hydrocarbon extraction. What happens for them, for those ecologically and socially? There are like thousands of people who have been living in those areas and who had suffered consequences of pollution and social dispossession and so on. And if we just then say these sites are no more interesting, we go for other sites for solar power production and wind power production. So are we going to forget altogether those people and those areas? Still, I would like to add one or two more aspects. We also, if we speak about climate justice nowadays, we also need to take into account the multi-species justice. It's not just the question of humans. It's also the question of other species and non-human aspects. And then my additional comment is that when we speak about justice, we also need to speak about responsibility. Whose responsibility it is that we have so many injustices? And just briefly, it cannot be a single universal responsibility, but it should not be either like a certain kind of individual self-responsabilization. We should take into account that there are certain kind of structural issues and some decision makers are more responsible than others.
Thank you, Anja. Senia, would you like to comment?
yeah, thanks. I very much agree with Anja and Bon and maybe providing an additional perspective. From justice perspective, it's not just the consequences of climate change that we need to address, but it's also the reasons behind climate change and one of the root causes of climate change and biodiversity crisis and resource crisis and many other environmental crises is overconsumption. We simply use too much energy and resources at the moment, especially in global north, and I don't think that's without addressing overconsumption and doing something about it, we are just not able to solve climate crisis in a fair manner and in a just manner. And as Anya said, it's not just about shifting from fossil fuels to renewable energy, because then we come, we need to address the questions of how do we produce these renewable energies and how do we like meet the growing need for energy with renewable energy production, instead of like trying to think of the ways to simply consume less and be happy with the energy production we already have, for example. And this is related to not only consumption, of course, but also the production as the other side of the coin. Like we need to produce the energy, but also clothes, food, everything we consume, and that also causes a lot more pressure for those people who already suffer from the consequences of climate change also, like the excessive production of related to agriculture, forestry, mining. The people, the consequences are more weighted towards Global South and people living in Global South. And that's overconsumption and related production is, I think, one of the key questions to address if you want to solve climate change in a just manner.
Thank you. So I would like Anya to start with this question, but what would a just climate solution for the Global South look like? And how can local knowledge and indigenous perspectives be integrated into global climate policy as well?
Yeah, always when we speak about justice issues or climate issues or whatever kind of environmental social issues, they have to be considered at multiple scales. And those scales, they are so interconnected that it's also difficult to separate them. So my point is that it's also important to consider that the Global North and Global South, they are also extremely heterogeneous between themselves. There are many differences between different countries, but also within countries. So if we consider what would a just climate solution for the Global South look like, it might be difficult to consider Global South as a monolith. So it's important to consider that there are different actors, different institutions, different views, different interests, which does not mean that we also need to consider differences between Global North and Global South, as Bon was saying. This question of indigenous or indigenous perspectives and local knowledge, it's quite challenging. But I would like to say that, without sounding to be essentialistic, I would like to say that we could learn from indigenous ways of living, like a more modest kind of life. Not like we live in the world where there are all kind of needs all the time, and if we do not have needs, somebody will take care of that. We will feel new needs. So, and the other aspect of indigenous way of living is, I wouldn't say that they are living in harmony with the nature, but maybe more like respecting nature. And that's something we could learn from them. I would also like to say that local knowledge or indigenous knowledge, we shouldn't think it only as a practical knowledge. I think we are undervaluing local knowledge if we say that it's just a practical knowledge that goes from generation to generation without changing at all. Instead, at least those indigenous knowledges I have been studying, especially in Latin America, they are extremely complicated ways of knowing, but they are different than ours. And they are integrally linked to their worldviews. So we cannot take just like small pieces of their knowledge and then try to put it in our different kind of system of knowledges. We have to understand it holistically. So I said we shouldn't be idealistic either, but we might be willing to think that they are living with nature and often living from nature. So maybe they have much better strategies of adjustment and resilience than we do. But I would be happy to give floor for others to add.
Yeah, it's a challenging question talking about solutions. But I see the climate crisis experienced by the Global South nowadays is accumulation of the many forms of violence that the Global North has inflicted on the Global South. And there is so many of this violence that the Global South is being subjected to and continue to suffer from. So these are multiple and simultaneous violence compounding the climate and environmental catastrophe. So the first is historical violence. So we all know the violent history of colonialism, including slavery and a lot of extractivism, where Anya is a specialist. The second is just military violence, which basically means the process of militarization. You know, all this creation of weapons of mass destruction, the powers now that the security and the arms industry have, you know, that led to the destruction and bombings of communities, nations, and civilizations. The third would be economic violence. So just 50, 60 years ago, we know neoliberal economic policies, the structural adjustment program imposed by the Global North to Global South countries in Latin America, in Africa, and in Asia. So those structural adjustment programs, neoliberalism, has really put the Global South into a debt trap or a debt bondage. You know, basically leading to deindustrialization, the destruction of economies, including our agriculture of the Global South, the destruction because of free trade and competition, the destruction of local businesses and enterprises. So neoliberal globalization also brought about a new division of labor, where it's just a perpetuation or a continuity of the continuous extractivism by the Global North of the Global South resources. We also, as part of economic violence, we see the consequences of the crisis of overproduction. So even Global South are compelled to produce for profits, not for needs. Yeah, that's the ethos of capitalism. And then, of course, very important link to the issue of indigenous knowledge. Oh, the Global South has also suffered from epistemic and cultural violence. So it's part of the deliberate ideology of Eurocentrism, US-American centrism, and also all these Western-centric solutions being offered. So from a Eurocentric and Western-centric perspective, local knowledges of indigenous communities in the Global South are treated as inferior. So in a way, this epistemic and cultural violence is about racial violence as well. It's racism. So when we talk about a just climate solution, so everybody should address sincerely and willingly the multiple Global North inflicted violence on the Global South. So on the first violence that I mentioned, so what's the solution to historical violence? It's historical atonement. You know, even at that level, there must be admission for past sins. And climate justice is not simply a matter of negotiation. But climate justice is a process of historical reckoning. And in historical reckoning, you recall the Black Lives Matter movement, it includes truth-telling and truth-seeking. And truth, as we know, is a prerequisite for healing, reconciliation, trust-building, and eventually the justice that we aspire for. So what's the solution to military violence? Of course, we call for demilitarization and peace. So all development and humanitarian assistance needed for building back better for all those communities that they have destroyed should be given. So what we call is to divest from wars and invest in life. You know? And then thirdly, on economic violence, I don't deny the importance of financial and economic reparations. They are very important. But the problem with the climate financing, the way they compute it, they have a very short time frame. So they only compute the recent past and then the near future. But a sense of climate justice would have an understanding of deep history and a far future, you know, intergenerational justice as we know it. And then another way to address economic violence would be debt cancellation to free up the resources of the Global South, yeah, to do climate change adaptation. And that would also entail technical and technological support and assistance for adaptation and mitigation. And lastly, which is a tricky one, which Anya mentioned, is about indigenous wisdom and knowledge. Of course, we call for, decolonizing knowledge production. But I don't also want to essentialize the community or romanticize the Global South or indigenous knowledge. We also know a lot during the pandemic experience, there are questionable cultural practices. So for me, I would like to have, respect and recognition, integration of local tacit knowledges and indigenous wisdom, but they should also have continuous dialogue with science and technology know-how. Yeah. So maybe I'm appealing for faith-based or belief system-based practices in caring for nature with the knowledge coming from scientific research and technological advancement. So, but another thing, Anya mentioned about the Global South. And I come from the Global South. We have so many problems in there. There are autocrats and there are militarization happening. So I talk about lots of violence, but one important and sensitive thing in the Global South is state violence. You know, the degree of violence that advanced countries or democracies here in the Global North is not really the same as the kind of mortal threats and deaths and killings being suffered by environmentalists and communities, the displacements in the Global South. So you see there national government and state leaders in alliance with domestic capitalists, you know, miners, and also foreign capital. And that's the violence that we really need to do. And even if indigenous communities would come up with this way of land commoning, alternative ways of doing, you know, if you do that in the Philippines with militarization of the countryside, you will be accused of being communist and terrorist. And that's very dangerous. So, and that is a way on how, probably how the global institutions can come in, because they can be a watchdog or a guarantor globally, internationally, to say these are legitimate local indigenous commoning practices. They are not, well, violent communist or terrorist. So I think that's one of the practical ways that you know, local efforts on caring for the environment can be linked to global international institutional decision-making. Yeah.
Sanya, do you have anything you want to comment?
Well, I really liked Anya's idea of appreciating the modesty from the, like, experiences of indigenous people, and that made me think of the three strategies of all kinds of policies, for example, energy policies, that are efficiency, consistency, and sufficiency. And the two first are the mainstream strategies in the current energy policies. For example, efficiency refers to having the same with less resources, like being able to consume as much as now, but just using less resources when doing so. And consistency refers to producing the services by using different production tools, for example, replacing fossil fuels with renewable energy. But sufficiency hasn't been included in policies, but that's something that hopefully is becoming more mainstream. And sufficiency refers to reducing the consumption and production to meet the planetary boundaries, for example. And here we need, I believe we need a lot of knowledge from local communities and also the indigenous people to find ways to live well within planetary boundaries that many people are able to do already now, but we have just like lose that ability on the way.
Thank you, Sonia. I just had a quick comment that perhaps you guys can consider as well. This one point that came up to me recently was that how in the Global South, then there are so many communities that are just struggling to even get access to electricity, clean water, and the basic needs. But then in the Global North, we're talking about how we can do green consumption, et cetera. Then, so this, is this issue adequately addressed as well? Just having the basic guarantee of electricity, clean water.
Yeah. Quite many social scientists who study climate justice, they also emphasize that instead of doing like simplistic impact analysis, like how, for example, flood disaster affects certain people, we should make multiple drivers vulnerability analysis. And this would tell us that it's not just the single flood event as such which has certain impacts, but you should take into account like multiple matters, like those who suffer most from the flood disaster, they are often people also who have very poor housing, who do not have access to sanitation, for clean water, for health care, and so on. So in this sense, I think it makes much sense to look the whole portfolio of vulnerabilities that certain groups of people have, and others are just like, as you said, that they are just enjoying the green transition in the way that I can continue to consume, I can continue to have the same kind of way of life, just that, for example, the energy is produced in a, so I do not have to take rid of anything in my way of life. I can just get the energy in another way, and in that sense, I think if we consider justice issues, we are not in the right path if we don't consider the inequalities that exist.
I think those provisioning should be done. We expect those to be delivered by governments. But I think I would like to mention that because I wrote something about movements and social movements. And why it's always difficult to change mentalities and, you know, mobilize people. Yeah. So we always say we have to arouse and mobilize people. Because climate justice is a big thing and a big issue. Many can't relate to this very nebulous concept. But I think we should go back to the idea of a human species. I think even Charles Darwin and Karl Marx wrote about the law of historical development. That, so I call it like, you know, activists, climate justice activists should also look into the politics of the everyday. Yeah. So a movement of the everyday. Yeah. So that means addressing the day-to-day needs of people. I think, was it Darwin or Marx who wrote about that we need to address first the needs of people for food, water, shelter, before they can think about politics, religion, and other advocacies that we have. But the climate justice movement is now broadening, and that is also being accounted for nowadays in the idea of putting in social justice, the idea of human dignity and basic needs, and then before it could move to a lot of transitions that we are happening. But I think that's just my message here, is that we should have a climate justice movement for the everyday. You know, an everyday movement. Yeah.
Thank you. So the next theme of the discussion will be climate solutions. I think we'd like Senja to start. So the focus on individual action is often criticized as a distraction from systemic change. But how can individual responsibility, cultural transformation, and policy reform work together to support more sustainable ways of living?
I'm talking about overconsumption again, because that's what I'm going to do the whole evening. But in this situation where the global crises are not just some kind of a distant future problem, but the problem of now and today, I think we need both individual action as well as systemic changes. But these go hand in hand. In our everyday lives, there are the structural frames within which we act and consume and live our everyday lives. The classical example is that we cannot use public transportation if there is none available, or we cannot cycle to work if the cycling routes are inconvenient or even dangerous. So we need policies that makes the sustainable choices and climate-friendly choices easier. But we also need policies that make unsustainable behaviors and consumption patterns more expensive or less desirable. And that's not something that is done in current politics. The responsibility for solving climate change is put on individual action instead of like governments and intergovernmental actors having the courage to do the difficult structural changes related to, for example, flying or meat consumption or private driving or taxing overconsumption or luxury excess consumption or just like taxing the excessive wealth. And I feel that we need these policies also for cultural change. I don't know how many of you or in audience remembers that before it was perfectly normal to smoke everywhere or not use seatbelts in cars, and now we couldn't even think of doing these things. They are just like unthinkable. So cultural transformation happens when policies steer these practices and we have this regulation and laws that make us not do certain things. And actually surveys show that many Finnish people, for example, are in favor of more ambitious climate policies and restricting like harmful consumption. But of course, there are, as Anja and Bon already mentioned, there are a lot of powerful actors, fossil fuel corporations, vested interests that make doing these political choices really, really difficult and slow down the change we should be doing in the societies. And what I feel is that we would quite urgently need more public discussion on the role of these powerful actors for solving the climate change or climate crisis and making the consumption and production patterns more sustainable and us as societies being able to get to the planetary boundaries we are exceeding like tremendously at the moment. The overconsumption day in Finland was like already almost a month ago. So this is not something we can continue doing. We need both actions from individuals as consumers to make the conscious choices of trying to do their best to mitigate climate change, but we also need actions from individuals as citizens to demand the change from policymakers and initiate the political and cultural change by their action and requiring like better and more ambitious policies in Finland and in the EU.
Thank you, Sanja. Does Bon or Anja have any comment?
When we talk about climate solutions, question about the individual, the cultural, and then the institutional, I'll probably follow up on what Sanja mentioned. For me, I problematize the process of consciousness formation. You know, how do we form consciousness of individuals that are pro-climate and pro-environment? You know, that kind of green consciousness is not a given. Yeah, it's a consciousness and awareness to be formed, and it's also a skill to be developed. So even my sense of activism, if I reflect on myself, if you know, how was my progressive consciousness came about? There are three main aspects. One would be through education. Depends where you studied. But many of us, probably as youth, we had cohorts and classmates who are progressives and even communists even during your youth. But then they are doing different things nowadays. Yeah, so they are working for corporate and fossil empires. Yeah? So they have changed. Education can just do as much, you know. But once you start, someone starts paying you money and do your job, it, that consciousness may change. Okay. Another way where consciousness is formed, aside from education, is socialization. Who your friends are, your community, you know, your group, you know, the way people you associate with, that affects to your consciousness. But then the third, which is important and something that we can do about, even as an academics and policy advisors, is on institution. Because institutions can create consciousness of individuals. If you look at, you know, culture is not something to be just respected. You know, culture or way of thinking is an arena of struggle and opposing tendencies. So there are cultural practices that should be re-examined, and it can change over time. So we can create a culture that is pro-environment and pro-climate. And institution and policy making can help in that. If you look at the strategizing being done by neoliberal institutions, by the World Bank, the IMF, UN agencies, OECD, look at their global education policy, you know, in the human capital framework. So curriculum and pupils, students will have to be shaped into being a neoliberal and capitalist agents. So our students are being prepared to be fully exploitable proletariat, yeah, ready to be in and out of the market and the labor market, or being entrepreneurial. So the strategy now in the education policy that they are doing, so they have tapped into neuroscience and behavioral economics, yeah, in shaping economic policy and creating neoliberal capitalistic agents and human beings. So if we do that in policy making, that if we push like the OECD and the World Bank and UN agencies to also alter education policies and related to that the economist of future to be more environmental and climate friendly, it can be done. So for me, we really have to think about the process of consciousness formation. They are doing that, and they know to do it. It's just that they have a different talos, you know. They have a different goal in life, and they have the different strategy. They are creating, you know, consumerist and neoliberal and capitalistic agents.
Thank you, Bon. Do you want to say something, Anya?
Yeah, I think there were there were interesting issues. I agree with both, but it's an interesting question that which is the cause and which is the consequence. That do we need to? Is it so that we change our behavior, for example, related to energy consumption or consumption in general? If first our attitudes change and we get the awareness of the problems, that's one way, and it can be very efficient. It can be also like very motivating, so that we do not live in a world that is a governance of controlling and disciplining people, that people are motivated by themselves if their attitudes change. But the problem in that kind of change is that it's very slow. Mm. It takes for a long time. So what Senja was just saying is, I think the seat belts that we use in our cars, they are a very good example that first they put the policy that everyone needs to start to use them. And I was a child when that policy came, and I remember my neighbors and my parents, they were like saying, "No, they are seeing us." They were very angry. And after a year or two, everyone start took it for granted that we it's our right to use them. So maybe we should have like a combination of having certain kind of policies that urge and almost oblige us to make changes. But at the same time, we also need like education and awareness and consciousness of the problems.
Senja. Yeah, and just briefly continuing from there, that's when we talk about individuals and changes in consumption, we need to remember that attitudes and values are not individual either, but they are, we don't live in a vacuum, but we learn our values and attitudes from other people, from schools, from parents, from friends. So it's not just like us individually developing our values, but they are part, we are part of the society we live in, and the values come from there. And in that sense, we also need to change the institutions and policies, and we cannot rely on like individuals, like individually changing, because as Anja mentioned, it's also like way too slow to solve the present crisis.
Thank you. So the next question was going to be for Anni Marttinen, who unfortunately couldn't come tonight because she was sick. But I would like to ask the question anyway, because I think you all have something to say. So the IPCC has called current development paths unsustainable. So what alternative economic models, for example, degrowth or well-being economy, offer realistic and just pathways forward? And I was hoping that perhaps Senja could... Senja could begin. Thank you.
I'm not an expert in economic models, but I was thinking about this question, and we just had the midterm policy review of the government, as everyone probably knows, where there were these tax cuts and so on. And again, related to that, I was thinking that the current economic model is often seen as something neutral and free from values and ideologies, and then again these like alternative models such as degrowth and well-being economy are seen as really ideological and so on. And it's really important to remember that none of these models, including the one we are currently like having, are not value free or free from any kind of ideologies. And what we actually would need quite urgently is more discussion on what kinds of values underlie these different economic models, and what does this mean for sustainability and welfare. And for example, the current government talks about the importance of these political decisions regarding, for example, budget cuts for economic growth and welfare. But what does this welfare mean for them? Whose welfare are they talking about? Who are being left out, also globally? So this kind of like broader discussion on values and goals of these economic models is currently missing. And I don't feel that the alternatives like degrowth or post-growth or well-being economy, they have their own problems, and I'm not sure if they are as such realistic. And there are also like several ways to understand degrowth and more like stricter and more like flexible alternatives. but at least we should more openly talk about them as alternatives and what's new or what kind of alternative they even could bring instead of just like declaring them as unrealistic as I think is currently done in political discussion. Those we don't even get the chance to talk about these before they are like declared as like problematic and unrealistic.
Thank you, Sonja.
Yeah. Economic models, there are many being experimented on. Degrowth may work, so but the degrowth advocates are focusing that much more on the global north responsibility, so about reducing production, consumption, and emissions. And then there are these calls about the sharing economy and the well-being economy. I think the alternative economic model should problematize this growth obsession and the growth mania. Because what we are seeing being implemented at the moment is what we call life-shortening economic policies. So we hear all of that in different economic strategies and policies and plans, even here in Finland. You know, a lot of those talks about productivity obsession. Yeah, all those talks of the European Commission and Europe about competitiveness and Finnish competitiveness also. So those are also what we call life-shortening policies. It's also related to climate because it will be based on overproduction, overconsumption, and also all this extractivism. It leads to climate disasters, and if other countries suffer from that, even you know, human beings are supposed to live maybe 90 to 100 years old. But now those who suffer from climate disasters only maybe half or even less of that because of man-made disasters. And then it's also linked to austerity policies. Yeah? So cuts on welfare, you know, including care for the elderly and for the youth. Productivity obsession, so that means they don't really care for the health and well-being of the workers. You just keep on working. Yeah, life is all about working and being just productive citizens. And I think in terms of economic model, we have to contest the mainstream prevailing ones, which is based on the tragedy of the commons, which is basically a fable. So it assumes, and which all of economic mainstream models are based, that human beings are rational. So they act on the basis of self-interest. So that's why commons thinking is not possible, because everybody is just selfish and egoistic. Yeah? And that economic model and thinking should be contested. Yeah, because historically, on record, you know, those who have caused so much damage in societies, economies, and the environment are actually individualistic and capitalistic behavior. We can also think about regenerative you know, economic strategies. But for me, I think one of the feasible economic model is to think about these ideas of the commons and the commoning. Yeah.
Thank you, Bon. Anja?
Yes, I pretty much agree that the economic models, they are, or when we make economic decisions or policies, there are no value-free options. Like, there are no neutral options. Or there are, you are always prioritizing something, and giving less emphasis on others. But as Senja said, I'm not an expert on economic modeling. But maybe this does not go too far away if we speak about climate justice. It's also important to consider that there are so many losses and so many harms, so many hazards that are difficult to even consider just like economic ones. I have been myself studying oil extraction in places where there are huge problems of pollution, salinization, environmental degradation, huge impacts of local livelihoods and life worlds. And what the companies have made, they pay single payments for local farmers and fishers for losing their harvest or for died animals like cows and cattle who have died because of the they have consumed, for example, polluted water. So single payments for a loss of harvest. But there is no question when local people and justice advocates, they say that, but you also need to consider the wider long-term degradation, like pollution which accumulates in sediments and soils, and the health issues, which also often accumulate over time. And how about the destruction of people's lived environments? And also the effects of, like, mental effects of them for destroying their life worlds and so on. So how can you compensate them economically? It's difficult to separate from other kind of more epistemological issues, or as Bon was saying, epistemic violence.
Thank you, Anja.
Yes, so let's finally focus on the future and climate change in more detail for the last 30 minutes or so. So let's imagine a future where we have successfully tackled the climate crisis in a just and sustainable way. What does that word look like, or what could it look like? And what are the most critical changes needed today to make it a reality in the future? Who would like to start? It's a big question.
Futurist thinking is always a challenge for academics.
Would you want like to start anyway?
What does that word look like? I imagine what I call a post-capitalist world, where we would have where human beings would have a harmonious relationship with nature and the environment and climate. But a precondition for that human-nature relationship would be a harmonious relationship between human beings. Yeah, we should have that kind of reconciliation. And that would that future would entail an alternative mode of production. So it's not just climate justice is not just about a question of redistribution, but it's a fundamentally question of the mode of production. How do we produce? And at the moment, we are producing in such a way that we are extractivist, fossil fuel dependent. And then if you have an alternative mode of production and a productive structure, that would also require an alternative energy source that is not any more dependent on the fossil oil and gas. And then, aside from the alternative mode of production, there should be an alternative system of exchange. So where market is not treated as a goal, but market is only a tool to realize a good life or the common goods. And that would entail for me several economic policy shifts. And I believe that we could return to having economic strategy towards full employment or job guarantee. Because you can create jobs that can be green or pro-environment that saves the nature. Yeah, but right now the economic models is based on growth GDP obsession. So an economic policy from growth to full employment and job guarantee. But that must be coupled with basic incomes and unconditional and universal. So because not everybody needs to be in productive labor, let others who would like to do creative work. And also basic income is needed for self-cultivation, and it can also benefit the environment. And then aside from basic incomes, you need basic public social services. Or we can aspire for the welfare state. Yeah, so that the basic necessities that you talk about and on food, shelter, healthcare, housing are taken good care of. So those are the what I've been thinking. So a harmonious relationship between humans and nature, and between human beings, and also having all these policies that I'm talking about, you know, on full employment, on basic incomes, and also public services and social welfare policies.
Would you, Anja, like to continue?
Yeah, what else to add? When we speak about so-called developing countries or global south, what is characteristic of them is not that everyone is poor, but characteristic is huge inequalities. And I think one of the questions that needs to be solved somehow is this inequality, and also like stop those kind of tendencies that are related to land grabbing and resource grabbing that is growing all over the world. But what Bon was saying, I think we need, I don't know how, but we need binding systems of policy implementation. Because we might have, like in many countries, if we look at their policies, they might have quite advanced policies, for example, against deforestation or labor rights policies and so on, but then they are never implemented. And we need wise kind of systems of governance and regulation. We have had systems of very strong regulation by controlling everything, but we have also had systems of soft governance, like relying on market-based governance, and they have not worked well either. So maybe we need hybrid forms of governance. And then not, if we speak about climate issues, we should have systems that do not allow free riding. And maybe also to stop this kind of ideology that everything is for sale, like everything is commercialized. If we think, for example, it's not no more that the different kind of items are for sale. but also different kind of knowledges, different kind of experiences, different kind of feelings, different kind of memories. A good example is tourism. Nowadays, what is sold for us is not so much like buy this and that handicraft, but buy this and that experience. So why everything needs to be commercialized?
Yeah, yeah, it's
the commodified future, as we call yeah. it.
It's really difficult to add anything to this, but I very much agree, and continuing from the consumption scholars are often talking about upper and lower limits for consumption, where the upper limit is defined by planetary boundaries and the lower limit by social sustainability, being able to fulfill basic needs and having equality, education, income, and so on. And for, I think what is important is that globally everyone is able to meet that social lower limit of sustainability, be able to live a good life, and that requires that many of us in global north reduce their consumption in a way that resources can be divided more equally, because we are living in a world with limited resources. There aren't more minerals in the ground. We cannot generate endlessly energy, because we need the minerals to produce the energy from sun and from wind and so on. So we need ways to be able to divide the existing resources in a fair and just manner, so that everyone is able to meet their basic needs and live a good life within planetary boundaries. And I think there were a lot of different solutions already presented by Anja and Bon. And what that tells is that there are solutions already existing. As Anja said, there are good policies. There are many, many, many nations have really good policies, and they just need to be implemented and transported to other contexts, and having this more like solidary approach to mitigating the climate change and mitigating overconsumption and overproduction. We have we know how to build rails, we know how to build cycle lanes, we know there are trials on 4-day work weeks and things like that. There are all kinds of things experimented and tested, and we just need to like gather these solutions together and like start implementing them on a larger scale.
Let's still continue on the topic of the future. So what can we learn about reality and ourselves through the process of solving climate change in a comprehensive way? How could the knowledge and realizations reached through this process help us in other ways? You can comment on individuals or societies or the planet as a whole. Who would like to start?
So you're asking about the biggest obstacles now?
What can we learn about ourselves and reality and society through the process of solving climate change in the right way? What could we learn? What other things could we learn about how we should live on this planet? You can start, please, Senia.
I'm not sure if this is actually the answer to your question, but I think at least one thing that came to my mind is that we need to move on from this really individualistic idea of everyone taking care of themselves and start like taking care of each other and of the nature and the non-human nature as well. And we all know humans are eventually, we are social animals who should like collaborate instead of competing, and by working together and seeking the solutions and implementing the solutions, we can do actually quite a lot of good. And I think care is something that has been emerging, especially in consumption research, but I think also in other fields as well. Like, how could we embed the idea of care for others and for ourselves and for the non-human nature better into policies and practices, because that's something that I think it's really important to be able to solve the crisis and the politics is done for the welfare of people and the planet, and then that should be at the core of all the decisions that are being made.
I would like to continue. You can answer it in a broad way.
What can we learn about reality? I think we should understand, everybody should have an understanding of political economy. You know, that there is so much politics, and that's the biggest obstacle, and vested interests around. So that must be overcome. And I think one of the biggest problems why we cannot move forward effectively in addressing climate change is that of the absence of a global vision. And there's no sense of meaning and purpose of our existence beyond our individual selves and national boundaries. And what I have also realized is that it's very important for us to resist to exist, because if we don't resist capitalism and colonialism and extractivism and their associated cultural practices, we won't exist anymore. So resist to exist, and importantly, resistance is not enough. We have to rebel against extinction.
Yeah, please.
Yes, when we speak about energy transition, transition often has a meaning that it's a small, little by little kind of change. And there are many who also say that instead of speaking about cosmetic transitions, we would need more bigger transformation related to the ways how energy, food, different kind of items, knowledges, how they are produced, how they are marketed, how they are traded, and how they are consumed. So I would call for more, not just a transition as such, but more like a transformation in our ways of living. And I totally agree with Bon that if climate issue or biodiversity loss or all those kind of environmental or social problems, if they would be just like technical matters, we had already solved them. But they are political matters in the sense of that there are competing agendas and interests. We need collaboration, but we also need compromises. It's not very probable that we will get a global consensus. That would be too difficult. But we need compromises so that you get rid of some of your claims, but you keep some principles. And then we also, as Bon was saying, we also need contestations. So in that way, maybe we can find out different ways of living in this planet.
Zena, please.
Yeah, and maybe continuing from there, I think much of our everyday life is based on idea of normality. What is normal? How? What kind of consumption is normal? What kind of food is normal? How is? What kind of behavior is normal? And these normalities are something we should critically evaluate and contest as well, because we are so used to living our everyday lives in certain ways that it's sometimes really difficult to open these normalities and meanings underlying our everyday practices, open them up and critically evaluate them, like why am I doing like this? Why are everyone else doing like this? And how could this be changed towards like more sustainable ways of acting?
Okay, thank you. It has been really interesting. Now it's time for your final thoughts. So is there something left unsaid that you would still like to say, or some concluding remarks, or something new that you come to think about during this discussion? Who would like to start? Would you like to start?
Yeah, maybe I would like to end by citing Mark Taylor, who is a scholar in climate issues, in climate justice. And he has said, if I remember it well, he has said, confronting climate change is not about how to respond to an external threat, external problem. It is how to produce ourselves differently. So we all have responsibility.
Tina, please.
I'm very lucky to have many friends that always remind me of the importance of not giving up hope, because we are in really like a difficult situation when it comes to all the like different crises in climate crisis and biodiversity crisis and everything, and then there are these like inequalities and all the social problems also, and it's really important that not to lose hope, because when we lose it and think like, well, this is it and there's nothing we can do, then well, things at least then they go badly, but if we just keep on doing our best as responsible consumers and citizens and researchers and individuals and members of communities, then we still have hope and like strength to demand better policies and practices.
Yeah, I give importance to the process of forming a counter movement, which should also be a learning movement. And if you're a learning movement, we have to also unlearn many of the bad habits and systems. So we have to resist and rebel against the systems, ideologies, and habits of capitalism and colonialism. And in them, you know, individualism, materialism, consumerism, racism, and white supremacy. So this learning movement, which is hopefully the climate justice movement, should be anti-capitalist, anti-colonial, and anti-racist, which should also form, you know, a counterculture that is very much into leading towards a more harmonious relationship between human beings and nature.
Thank you, everyone. We now have some time for audience questions. If anyone has anything in mind. Max?
Thank you. Thank you so much for this wonderful discussion, and I really enjoyed it was an honor to listen each of you. Today I was participating in another event, and there I heard something new, and I would like to ask for your opinion about it. So it was about how we could transform the ethics of care and thinking about how we do ecological care. So if we would consider it as a form of labor, or and to think about also the, like in the similar way what we think about social reproduction or yeah, things that have been discussed in that type of a framework. So, but just to think about it, if it would make any difference. You can take other questions as well, I think.
Would you maybe like to still answer this question first?
Then yeah, maybe we can collect.
Okay, we can collect, yeah. Then. Are there any more questions?
Also, thank you for the presentation. Very interesting thoughts. There were several times when this modest way of living was mentioned. So I always like a concrete question. So what would be a realistic way to aim towards this goal of modest way of living?
Maybe room for one more question if there is anyone who would like to ask.
I think she's...
Or maybe I'll just go with these two.
Another question.
I bet she wants to ask.
Okay, would anyone like to start with either question, modest living or the ethics of cares and labor?
Well, I could respond to the question of modest way of living. I think there are a lot of examples of people actually living very modestly already. People being happy with smaller homes or not having a car or not buying new stuff all the time. And I have been studying these people a little during my research career, and what is really interesting is that sometimes these people feel that it's really difficult to live in this way because they are seen as a bit weird and like not doing the normal thing of buying a new phone every year or having their brand new clothes all the time. And I think that, and that's also related to the question of housing and how big home, how much space we need in our homes. And the, I have been analyzing some of the media discussion related to the topic, and people or living small is often considered something bad. Like we should aim all the time. We should aim for bigger homes and having more space around us, and these kinds of like discourses on what is normal should change so that people would feel that it's okay and it's normal to be happy with what you have and not aiming towards more and bigger and better all the time, but like yeah, being happy with what you have, and that's something that people actually feel quite difficult when they try to do this, and then they have to like explain their lifestyles to others, like constantly. So, yeah, there are lots of examples of how people can live actually quite sufficient lives when it comes to like resource consumption and still be very happy, but they have there is this tension between like living sustainably and having to explain it to others.
I think the fundamental problem in the ethics of care, social reproduction, and also the question on modesty is capitalism, which is the real crisis that underpins climate change. They say that capitalism has resolved so many crises, but it is climate crisis that and climate change that capitalism cannot solve. So basically, capitalism do not care at all. Capitalism does not care about the well-being of the workers, the well-being of the society, the well-being of the environment, the well-being of the climate, and the well-being of the planet. So capitalism does not care at all. So it doesn't have the ethics of care. Related to that problem is that decision makers, including individual governments, from the global north to the global south, so the way they address climate problem is based on techno-managerialism or being so economistic. So they are still based on the logic and motivation for profitability. And capitalism is about, well, they do business, they produce things, so long as other people will pay for the cost and the harm. So you have to privatize the profit, but then socialize the risk. And that entails also exploitation of the environment. That's fundamental capitalism. It doesn't have the ethics of care we are looking for. And then it's related to the idea of social reproduction. So social reproduction is the process of how do we reproduce human species and society. So the social and economic policies that we have is that we are reproducing neoliberal, entrepreneurial, and capitalistic agents and human beings and extractivists to the environment. So that's the kind of social reproduction that this capitalist framework that we are operating. Of course, they are not really based on any form of modesty, because it's basically about producing for profits instead of producing for needs.
Maybe I can continue. I don't know if I understood well what you had in mind or what the scholars in the other event had in mind when they were speaking about the ethics of ecological care. But I always also want to think that environmental and social, they are so related with each other that it's difficult to distinguish them. And if we speak about environmental care or ecological care or environmental social care, I think it should be part of our way of life. Of course, we also need some knowledge, like also ecological knowledge, how to take care of it. But I'm also thinking about many local communities and indigenous people with whom I have been, whom I have been studying and with whom I have been living for long times, especially in Latin America. Their way of living is that, for example, how they take care of their chickens, or in Andean regions, of their llamas or alpacas. It's a different kind of care. Like they speak about but I have to take care of my plants. They are my plants. It doesn't mean they think in the way that they are my property, but they are like, this is my responsibility and this is my way of life, of taking care of those plants. And also when looking some people, for example, who have, what is their relationship with their horse or with their mule? It's almost like the horse is like a continuation of their body. So it's not separate from them when they are, for example, working. They know very well, they know how to interpret the moments and feelings and concerns and of animals. And at least in urban areas, maybe we have lost some of those sensitivities. So but at the same time, I think there is a certain kind of ethics of care, but it has been pretty much commoditized. And if we take an example of academic world, there are still some areas where we do it by solidarity or by caring. For example, when we do peer reviewing of scientific manuscripts, they are never paid for. And often also when we review research proposals, today I got an invitation again to review some research proposals, and it first said, remember, we do not pay for anything because this is academic task. And I think it should be so. If we start to pay for those tasks, the whole system of solidarity goes away. Like, I peer review manuscripts for others if they are willing to do it for me. And also for not commercializing it or for not paying for it, it also prevents all kind of corruptions.
And yeah, following up on chicken and cows, I don't think in the present system of mass production there cannot be ethics of care for the nature, because the animals and plants and trees are just seen as tools or objects of mass production. And if we want to change this system, then we need to change the whole like system of production and consumption, because there cannot be this kind of like mass production where we only see these living beings as like sources of our like mass consumption.
Yeah, it's really. Yeah, the commodification that is really part of capitalism. So it's about reducing valuable beings into wasteful things. So that's the logic that we are really operating on, and that's not really so modest at all. I mean, it's just a world of waste that they're trying to promote. I mean, capitalism does not care for the well-being of workers and families and the society, the planet, unless society and social movements and like us, you know, force them to do so. So there must be an agency on our part.
And then the waste is also a commodity nowadays.
Waste is a commodity. It's true. It can be sold and bought.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, everyone. Our time is just about up. But as we mentioned before, this discussion has been recorded and will be available on our website and YouTube channel soon. please share it with anyone who you think might be interested. We will be posting more information about that on our social media accounts. And I would like to once again thank our guests for being here tonight, our volunteers, our photographer, and our audience. Thank you very much. And we will also be sharing more information about our September event soon and hope to see you all there again. Thank you very much. Thank you.